Good morning. So what I want to do is this. I think we've noticed throughout the course of the year, we've focused in on several stories that seem to be... It was rough. There are several stories that seem to be almost scandalous. We had Yehuda and Tamar. We had Yaakov marrying two sisters, Rachel and Leah, which also is not as scandalous, but again, something which the Torah prohibits later on. We had the story of Yehudas when it came to Hanukkah. We had Yael and Sisera. We had Esther.
Moshe marrying a second wife.
That was on Tuesday, it was on Monday. But right, we had Moshe marrying a second wife, possibly. That's Monday. And we had Esther, and then most recently we had Ruth. And all these cases, I mean, you can imagine what the newspapers would say about any of these stories. So, I think the overarching question is, which we've kind of been wondering, is why do things always have to happen in this way? What was part of Hashem's plan in that any time there's going to be a salvation for Kal Yisrael, there's going to be strong roots established for the Malchus, for Melech HaMashiach, that Yehuda and Tamar, out of them is going to come David HaMelech, from Ruth is going to come David HaMelech, Esther saves the Jews, Yael saves the Jews, Yehuda saves the Jews, all these people are doing such amazing things, so why does it always have to come through these types of... questionable means. And it starts even earlier. The truth is, if we look, if you look at the ancestry, we'll try to probably zero in more just on focusing on David HaMelech, although I think some of what we're going to say will answer even the broader questions in terms of things of other salvations of the Jews that didn't relate specifically to David. But if you look at the lineage of David HaMelech, so on his, from his father's side, but in terms of so one side of the family is from Rus. So where does Rus come from? Rus comes from Moab. And where does Moab come from? An incestual relationship. Lot's daughters thought that the world was coming to an end, and they got drunk and they slept with their father. And maybe their intentions were completely l'shem shamayim, which is good, fine. But it seems a little bit it's not good for shidduchim. I mean, that you're coming from rooted in this relationship, and then Rus. She's coming from Moab. She converts, which again isn't necessarily a problem, but it required a whole drasha to figure out whether her conversion was even good or not. Many thought that her conversion wasn't good initially because from Moab the Torah said you're not allowed to. Okay, so the drasha limited it's only the men are not allowed to convert, but women are. And then she needs to basically go into the threshing floor in the middle of the night to seduce Boaz or something. Again, what exactly played out? Not exactly in that way, but in terms of what was developing, that's one place that David HaMelech comes from. And then from that, as the Megillah concluded, comes out Yishai and David. And then the truth is that there were even rumors going around. It's not for right now, but about the personal lineage of David HaMelech. There were those that thought that David himself was a mamzer, and that's why when the entire story, when Shmuel comes to see which of the sons should be the king, nobody even shows him David, because David was the outcast. He was completely separate from everybody else, and that's what they hinted to in the pasuk in Halal of Evan Ma'asu Habonim Haisal Rosh Pinah. The stone that was despised became the foundation. Who was the stone that was despised? It's talking about David HaMelech. It represents David HaMelech. David HaMelech was the one that was despised by everybody else, and then he becomes the one that's the foundation for everything to come. And then on the other side, you have for David HaMelech coming from Yehuda and Tamar. She also isn't the purest of relationships, and again, in terms of being a classic relationship where just, man marries woman, everything's happy, have children, and moving on. But Yehuda wasn't giving his son over for another Yibum, and Tamar basically dresses as a prostitute, seduces him, and out of that comes, that's what David HaMelech comes from. So it's pretty clear it's not coincidental. So why did it have to be like this? What's the Torah teaching us? What does Hashem want to teach us in terms of, something about the Malchus of Beis David, that it was fundamental to the establishment of Malchus Beis David that it should come about in such ways? So I found several approaches from earlier sources. A lot of it is found in this sefer that I was using on Rus from Rav Rivlin Shlita Kam Yavne, Rus David U Mashiach. That sums up all the people involved. And then I wanted to suggest one other approach, which I didn't see there, but I think perhaps adds another aspect to this as well. The first approach is that of the Sefer Im HaBanim Smecha. Im HaBanim Smecha is a very interesting Sefer. It was written by, I think it was a Munkacher, a Chassid, and basically is a justification for Zionism. And in his circles, it was not exactly a very popular notion. And he wrote this entire Sefer, a fascinating Sefer, basically justifying it. And part of what he discusses in this, again, I really don't want to zero in on this point, but what he's dealing with is one of the questions that he says that people have is if it's really true that the establishment and Zionism and the establishment of the current state is aschalta de geula, is the beginning of the geula. Says ich yitachen sherov bonei haaretz hemel da avoneinu mechalei Shabbos ve'over avera. So why is it coming out of you would think that if it's the beginning of the period of the Mashiach is coming, so it would be the tzaddikim, it would be the gedolei hador, it would be at least the people that were committed to Torah and mitzvos that would be the ones founding it, and yet we find that the opposite is true. And we found that it was mostly people who were completely secular who were the ones who, they were Jewish, but completely secular without any commitment to Torah and mitzvot, and they were the ones who took on the responsibility and took on the role of taking this important step forward. So we said some people say, okay, that in and of itself is proof that the whole thing is puzzle, and then it can't be, and we have to reject it. There's no way it could be the beginning of the Yeshua. So again, this is you know, really 2 pages in the entire book. But what he says is something which is very fascinating, and he basically brings it back to our point, which is that it's not a taina, it's not an argument that Yeshua, that salvation comes from what we call murky water. And he explains it as this, and which is exactly what we find in these other Yeshuos and what we find with David HaMelech in particular. And what he explains is like this, is that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do something big in the world, he wants to do something which is going to change, is going to alter the face of what the world looks like. He wants to do things that are going to not just even affect now, they're going to reverberate for generations and generations. So he needs to keep them hidden. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts in different ways. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Erech HaPayim. He acts mercifully. He waits to punish. He doesn't always give us what we actually deserve. So there are times that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do something in this world, and he's doing it out of chesed, and he's doing it out of his goodwill, and out of having mercy on the Jewish people. If at that moment, the Satan comes, and is mekatrig, again, argues with Hashem, and says, well, what do you mean? They're doing all these mitzvos. So then the way the system that Hashem has set up is that when an argument comes up, so then he deals with it. So if, again, it's not that he doesn't know it, it's just that it's a different midah. I mean, the midah of Hashem that he's using at this moment is the midah of chesed, but the same way, the mashal, again, just to try and make it maybe a little clearer, it's not an exact mashal, but if you're trying to, your child does something, and you're trying to, you know, trying to overlook what they did, and you just want to, you know, do something positive and try and, you know, move beyond that and not deal with that. And then they start flaunting and reminding you of what they did, so they don't give you a choice. You don't have any choice but to deal with the fact that, okay, I have to take out, I'm going to have to punish you for whatever that was, because it's just, when it's in your face like that, it kind of forces you to override the rachamim. Again, that's not exactly what's happening, but just a way of maybe giving a little bit of trying to make it a little easier to understand. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts with chesed, the way that he designed the world is in such a way that if the Satan then comes and says, well, look, Klal Yisrael are doing all these averos, how can you be doing this tremendous thing? So then Hashem will take the time and, you know, revisit the situation and look, well, maybe they're really not deserving, and then may force them to act with, and may force him to act with midas hadin, and it may in fact change and stop what he was planning on doing, and may reassess his plan. So what does Hashem do to avoid this? So what Hashem does is what these svarim, what the Im HaBanim Smecha, quoting from earlier sources, it says, is he gives shochad la satan. He bribes the satan. What does it mean to bribe the satan? So, again, obviously, if Hashem wanted to, he could really just avoid what the Satan was saying. He could do that. And he could just say, you know, I don't care what you're saying. I'm doing this. I'm God. You're not. And I'm moving on. What you see clearly is that Hashem wants things to work in as normal a way as possible. And He designed the world in a certain way, and He wants that design to continue unless He feels the need to intervene. So since He designed the world in such a way that when the Satan comes and says Bnei Yisrael are sinning, that He's going to revisit it, the option of doing something to distract the Satan to prevent him from saying something is more ideal than having the Satan say something and then Hashem saying, you know, I don't care about it, I'm just going to ignore it. So Hashem gives what He calls shochad la Satan,
which is really confusing the Satan.
So it's not exactly confusing him, it kind of refocuses him, and I'll try to elaborate on it. It's basically similar, this is also what he says there, it's similar to the way, again, if Bilam is coming to, almost up to that parasha, Bilam is going to curse the Jews. God clearly does not want Bilam to curse the Jews. So he has a few options. He has the entire parasha of Balak, and the entire story unraveling the way it does. Or he could just say, no, Bilam, why don't you just curse the Jews, and I'll ignore it, because I'm in charge and not you. And we see from the Torah that which option did Hashem choose? Hashem chose that He wasn't going to become angry for that day, so Bilam couldn't determine the exact moment at which Hashem was going to be angry, and because he couldn't determine the moment at which God was going to be angry, the curse was going to be completely ineffective. The other option seems a little bit easier. God just saying, curse them all you want, I don't care. But it's the same idea, is that Hashem designed the world to work in certain ways, and that apparently the way He designed the world was if at that very moment when God gets angry every day, the curse comes, then Hashem relates to it. Again, whether it's that His Midas Hadin is stronger at that time, we can't understand, you know, obviously fully the way Hashem works the world, but trying to understand a little bit in terms of what's revealed to us, is that it's clear that Hashem would prefer to make sure that the curse does not exist than to simply ignore the curse. And he explains that's why the Yeshua, the salvation of the Mashiach, comes through ways that on the surface seem to produce mamzerim, seem to be completely illicit, completely scandalous. Because the whole time, as the Yeshua, as the salvation is developing, the Satan is thinking, okay, everything's working the way I like it to work. Okay, Tamar is out on the crossroads, and she's acting like a prostitute, and she's going to bring Yehuda in. So the Satan says, I like what I'm seeing right now, this is all good. Now, in the background, what's really happening is that Hashem is organizing things in such a way that, in terms of what's not revealed, that is going to bring out the progenitor of the Melech HaMashiach. So again, since what Hashem is doing is such a large thing, meaning something which is going to affect the entire history of the world, the beginnings of the Melech HaMashiach, in order to avoid the Satan saying anything, he enshrouds it in such a way that the Satan has no reason to say anything, because in his mind, everything is unraveling in the way that he prefers. So he sees that what's going on there. He sees Lot's daughters getting him drunk and sleeping with him, and from that comes this child. That's great. You know, Satan loves incest. This is perfect. So everything is developing. This and Ruth going to the Gora in the middle of the night. Everything, you know, in the Satan's mind, he has no reason to say anything, because as far as things are developing, he doesn't see on the surface that Yeshua is coming, that salvation is coming to the Jewish people. And therefore, everything, Hashem keeps everything hidden, and that's the way he bribes the Satan. So when he confuses him in such a way, he gives him this little bit. He says, okay, I'm going to arrange that things are being done in such a way that the Satan will be happy. That's the bribe to the Satan. But under all of that is really the foundation and the beginning of the beginnings of salvation of the Melech HaMashiach. He only sees the Averos. He doesn't see what on a deeper level is happening. And the Noam Elimelech explains, based on this, a strange Medrash. The Medrash says, quoting a pasuk in Tehillim, that Hashem says, I found David my servant. And the Medrash says that he found David in Sodom. Okay, what was David doing in Sodom? What connection is there between David and Sodom? And when he explains this very idea, that sometimes the highest levels of Tumah, of Kedusha, of Tahara, have to be enshrouded in Tumah in order to protect them. So he gives a few examples. He says, isn't it strange? You would think that Avram Avinu is coming. You know, who are Avram Avinu's parents going to be? You'd think know, at least regular people, you know, people maybe also have begun to identify with monotheism, but who is it? It's Terach. It's the person who has the Avodah Zarah Shah, who's supplying the entire world, known world at that time, all of civilization with Avodah Zarah. That's where Avram Avinu is coming from. So it's the same idea that the purity that existed in Avram Avinu needed to be protected by having it in the place of Tumah. He says that's why Moshe Rabbeinu had to grow up in the house of Paro. Is that a place for the future leader, the Navi, who is beyond any other Navi we're ever going to have? That's the place where he should grow up, in the house of Paro? Said yes, because he sort of protected Moshe Rabbeinu, the Kedusha, the Tahara of Moshe Rabbeinu, by putting him in a place of Tumah where the Satan thinks, okay, chances are the influences of that house are going to be stronger, that Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to have any future with Klal Yisrael. But Hashem understands that no, this is the right place to put him. And then he points out, even in the original children that are born in the world, that Cain had two choices in terms of who he could marry in order to make sure that the world wasn't going to end. He could marry his mother, or he could marry his sister. Right? Nobody else exists. Adam and Chava were created. The only people that he could marry, and he didn't want the world to end, that he could have children with, is his mother or his sister. Okay, and he chose his sister. Apparently, we don't see that it was from his mother. Chazal tells us it was from his sister. Now, couldn't God have just created two couples and created another couple, and then there would have been somebody else to marry who wasn't related then? That wouldn't have been so complicated. No, but it's the same idea that if all the future of the world is going to be coming out of it, there was a certain amount of kedusha. Okay, what exactly was the kind of such a big tzaddik? We're not listening to our discussion. But in terms of that, he's going to be the one bringing out the future, which includes Klal Yisrael, which includes everything that's going to come. So it was hidden, again, none of this was forbidden at the time, but it was hidden in something which has a little bit more tumah in it. And it's just, that's one approach. That's the first approach in terms of trying to understand why is it that all of these levels of Kedusha seem to be coming from such scandalous sources. Is this idea of Shochad LaSatan, that Hashem, in order to protect the Kedusha, in order to make sure that the Satan isn't going to intervene and try and shut down the planet, force Hashem to act with Midas Adin, he does things in a way that it appears on the surface to be that there's Tumah, that there's some sort of Aveira happening, and therefore the Satan is distracted, and Hashem unfolds things in the way that he wants to have them unfold.
Strange. Now that it's all to, you know, influence the Satan not to pay attention to these. More, it should be a lesson for us more, you know, in terms of doing tshuva.
So I think there are those. I think we have four approaches. This is one aspect, and the approaches don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. I think there is more to it, right. But I think this is one again, yeah, on a level that we don't see so much. I think there are lessons for us as well. Absolutely.
Chet ha'egel, which they said the Satan mixed the days. So what
would they say then?
Like,
no, so why didn't Hashem protect it that it shouldn't happen? Obviously, he doesn't always do it. The question, I guess, at that point, there was no reason to do it. Meaning, if everything would have just gone the way it should go, if Bnei Yisrael would have, you know, just kept the status quo going, everything would have been fine. Here, it's when Hashem is trying to, again, the case that we've seen is when Hashem is trying to bring the change into the world. Again, it's very hard to ask why it doesn't happen in certain cases and happens in other cases, but this is the general idea in terms of where we do see it.
So, I know you spoke about this last night, but in terms of our own thoughts about Ayin Hara and Satan, I mean, we shouldn't be taking these lessons to ourselves then.
Right, no, this is something which God does. This isn't something for us to do.
Right, okay.
This is only the way that Hashem acts in the world. Our job is not to concern ourselves with the Satan. Our job is to do what we're supposed to do and the best way we're supposed to do it. Maybe a different time I'll repeat, so we'll go over the Shonai and Hara. I think there were several people who had asked. But, this is completely from the perspective of Hashem.
We shouldn't be hiding our...
Yes, we shouldn't be hiding in it. Yeah, not with things that seem... Although, I think there is an aspect of this which is very Lamaisa also.
Maybe you've spoken about this, because I think they might have this. But where did this Satan come from?
No, Hashem created... Hashem created... No,
sorry. Why would Hashem exist and why would
Hashem
feel such power?
And then to revolve at all his doings.
That's what I was trying to explain. That was the point I was trying to get. I mean, Hashem wants the Satan to do that because he designed the world in such a way that there are going to be those that are protecting Klal Yisrael.
But why is this such a powerful force?
So it's not so powerful. It's not so powerful. The Satan's power just is that the way Hashem designed the world is that when Chait is presented to him, he deals with it. meaning on his own, he may choose to push it aside, to ignore the wrong, gives the wrong connotation. I mean, he knows that's happening, but he chooses to let the midah of chesed override the din. The way that he designed the world is that when those averus are actually brought in front of him, then he deals with it. So if the satan is going to deal with it, so you're right. If Hashem was more powerful, and if he wanted to, could have changed all this and decided, I'm going to change the way that I designed the world and ignore the satan. What you see clearly, and that was what I was trying to bring out from the Bilam story, where Hashem didn't say, curse him, go ahead and curse, and I'm going to ignore it, but rather, is that Hashem, as much as possible, would rather orchestrate events in natural ways that seem a little bit strange. Again, it's just the way God chose to turn the world. That just seems to what emerges. Why He chose that isn't really for us to figure out. But the way Hashem chose to run the world is to let things unfold in what seems to be as natural a way as possible, as opposed to Him completely changing the order in which He established the world.
Yeah, so the question is, when did the Satan enter the world? At what point did that happen?
At the beginning. I don't know when Hashem designed the world in such a way that people were going to have a choice. I don't know exactly which day of creation.
And Yetzer
Hara and Satan.
What is it?
It's some sort of a malach. Sort of, I don't know exactly. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. That's definitely a broader question. I don't think that affects this point, but it can, I mean. Okay, so that's one approach. The second approach focuses on what's the purpose of creation. There seem to be different approaches to this, but what's the purpose? When God put us on this world, what did He put us here for? So one approach is basically to gain as much mitzvot as possible in order to be able to achieve as close a place to Hashem as is possible. The other approach is that part of our responsibility is to elevate the entirety of creation to reflect the fact that it is something which is created by God. I mean, to infuse the world with spirituality. And therefore, if it's necessary to see that Hashem is involved in everything in the world, even the things that appear to be most lowly, we have to somehow figure out there has to be a way in order to express that Hashem exists in everything. In things that we think are very lowly, somehow that's a reflection of the fact that Hashem is Melech HaLaretz Kevodo. Hashem's honor is everywhere throughout the world. And that's the idea that we're here to show that Hashem's Hashkacha and Hashem watches over everything that happens, not just the few special people. Okay, exactly. The scope of Hashkacha practice I'm not going to talk about right now, but in a very general way, that Hashem is in charge of everything that's going on and fully aware, and everything, even the things that aren't inherently kadosh, inherently holy, still have a connection to Hashem. So Rav Huttner explains, we refer to the Avos as the Merkava, the chariots of Hashem. The Chazar seem to refer to them as these chariots that are carrying Hashem's Kava. What exactly does that mean? What's the mashal of the chariot? So he says that normally when you have things that are being traveled around, they're being brought from place to place, as they lose their, things are mostly significant when they're in the place where everybody recognizes them, when they're in their regular place and everybody knows what they are, knows who they are, so that's when people or things are most significant. Once you start taking them out on a journey, so it loses some of that significance. You go to new places, you go elsewhere, and people don't appreciate the specialness of things, and the honor is diminished. But a chariot is the exact opposite. The whole purpose of the chariot, when you have a king that has a chariot, the whole purpose of the chariot is that wherever the king should go, everybody will see that he's a king. Meaning it's in order to make sure that the kavod of the melech doesn't just merely exist in the place where he is, but it extends everywhere that he's going. People are going to see, there's this chariot, somebody special, somebody important must be riding inside that. So the chariot actually serves to upend the general tendency of things that are moving around from place to place on a journey, that they become less significant, and it in fact makes the king even that much, it brings that much more honor to the king, that people in more places and more areas throughout the world appreciate what the king is about. And that's what it means that the Avos are a Merkava, is that the goal of the Avos and the goal of the Jew is to be the one to carry a reflection of Hashem and to be able to extend that everywhere that he or she goes. Everywhere we go in life is to be able to realize, okay, this is what a life of a Jew, this is what about a life of somebody who serves Hashem is all about. And the more we can spread that, that's this idea of reflecting this Melech HaLaretz Kevodo. And he says the idea of David and Mashiach coming from these lowly places is that proof. It ends up serving, and whether it's that Hashem wanted it to be in this way, or whether the people involved chose for to do it in such a way in order to reflect this, I'm not 100% sure. But the idea is that to show that even from the lowest places, you see that Hashem's Hashgacha there also. You see the hand of Hashem. Is that even in things which seem to be tumbling on the surface, Melech HaMashiach can come from there. There can be Kedusha if it's everything is dealt with properly, and everything can reflect the will of Hashem. And that's this idea, in a general term, of that Hashem should have a Dira B'Tachtonim. He should have a place to dwell in this world, and it shouldn't be something which is limited to a Mishkan, a Beis HaMikdash, a Beis Medrash, or to a Shul. It's something which is supposed to extend to every area of life. And that's why specifically when it came to those things that are going to be that which is most noticed, The Melech HaMashiach, that's something which everybody throughout the world is going to see and is going to say, wow, you know, at that time that everything, the levels and what the Bnei Yisrael have achieved is mind-boggling, it's so amazing, it's astounding. It all reflects back on the fact that it doesn't have to come from such significant places. And even from the things that seem lowly, there can be Kedusha there. Again, you have to know how to elicit it and how to bring it forth, which isn't necessarily easy, but people on these levels were able to bring that out. So in fact, the aspect of the Melech HaMashiach coming from these places that seem to be a little bit full, or have properties of tumah, in fact reflects that Hashem's jurisdiction is over everything in the world and is not limited merely to things that are inherently kadosh. Those are, again, two approaches to trying to understand this. The third is a very different type of approach. Until now, the benefits of the quote-unquote tainted lineage of the Melech HaMashiach revealed really what God's purpose was in doing this. That it should be reflected that He is the one in charge, that it should be His shochad to the Satan in order for him to be able to orchestrate world events in the way that He wants. But this one is actually for the benefit of the king, the benefit for the Melech. The Gemara in Yuma says, Daf Chaf Beis Amar Beis, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Mipnei Malo Nimshecha Machus Beis Shaul. Why didn't the monarchy of Shaul last? It was just Shaul, really, and that's it. How come? Why was it limited in its scope? And the Gemara answers, Mipnei Shelo Haya Bo Shum Dofi. There was nothing wrong with it. What exactly does that mean? So, and the Gemara supports it. We'll explain it shortly. The Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yotzadok. The Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yotzadok, Ein ma'amidin parnes al hatzibor, Elohim king kupa shal shrotzim tulu yolo me'acharav, Shema tazuach daitu alav, Omrim lo chazor l'acharecha. You do not appoint somebody as being the one in charge of the tzibor, the one providing for the entire tzibor, unless he has a kupa shal shrotzim, a box of worms, creepy crawly things hanging behind him, so that he shouldn't become a balgaiva, he shouldn't become haughty, and if he does, you'll tell him, look behind you. So what exactly does...
I'm going to say, then we dump
him. No, so what exactly does this Gemara mean? So Rashi explains, what does it mean that the Malchus of Shaul didn't last? There was nothing wrong with it. He says, Rashi says that there was nothing wrong with the Mishpacha. That Shaul came from pure lineage. What's the problem with that? These go hamalachim hayotzi mizaro al Yisrael, and that will cause, since he came from this, you know, pure pedigree, everything was perfect, that would cause them to become Baalei Gaiva in the future. They would become haughty kings over Bnei Yisrael. And that's the support that it brings from the Gemara. That what is it from this halacha that we don't appoint somebody on the tzibor unless he has this box full of the worms behind him. The kupa shal shratzim, it's metaphoric, dofi mishpacha, that he shouldn't have something that he should have to look back on and realize, you know, I didn't come, not everything was perfect from when I came from. And that's what the Gemara says, and if he begins to come haughty, say, look back at where you came from, not everything was so perfect, you know, you've accomplished a lot, but don't be, you know, too proud of that. And therefore, David HaMelech, who came from Moab, which came from Lot, it came from the story of Rus, it came from Yehuda and Tamar. That's a very different perspective on the Malchus. Right.
So
a benefit. Right.
So
the Maral explains this Gemara that the Mida of being a Baal Gaiva, of being haughty, is a very difficult balance for somebody who's in a position of authority, because on the one hand he does need a certain amount of gaiva. He needs to be able to project the image of authority in order to act properly. But at the same time, that same high position puts him in a situation where it can easily go to his head and cause the downfall and cause him to forget everything else that's important. And the one who's in charge of the tzibur is supposed to realize that he's not somebody who's above everybody else. He's one of the people who was appointed to do something in charge of everybody else. But he has to remember that his roots are as one of the people, one of the crowd. So in order to prevent the fact that he'll think that he's, you know, inherently above everybody else, that's what this Kupa Shel Shrotzim is about. It's something you can always remind him that, remember where you came from, and hopefully that will prevent any gaiva. When it comes to a king, the Torah tells us that some of the halachos in terms of limitations of what the king can have are the vilti rum levavo, are in order to prevent him from becoming a baal gaiva. And therefore, as much as it's true of all kings, certainly when it comes to the Malchus of Beis David, which is going to be the one that lasts forever, it was necessary, in order for the Malchus to be able to function in the best way possible, it was necessary for Hashem to make sure that there was something that wasn't perfect that they could then look back on and say, okay, you know, remember where you came from. You're right, you are the Melech. And you're right, you came from the Zera of David. But it doesn't mean that everything is perfect. It doesn't make you inherently better than everybody else. So Hashem provides the antidote. And he doesn't just provide a small box of worms. He provides a whole slew of them for these kings. And they have the story of Lot, and they have the story of with Moab, and they have the story of Rus and with Tamar. There's so much of it, and it helps to make sure that the king always remembers his place. And simultaneously, I think it also can be very inspirational, because it reminds the people that this is where the king came from. That everybody has ups and downs, that everybody falls at some point, and everybody makes mistakes. But there's the possibility of picking up and moving on. That the king, even the Melech HaMashiach, doesn't have to come from perfect lineage. Not everything has to be picture perfect. And there are times where everybody is going to falter at some point. And that doesn't mean that we're despised by Hashem. It doesn't mean that Hashem doesn't want us to pick up and be able to put it back together and try to come close to Him. And if a person says, you know, how can I possibly achieve spiritual levels closest to Hashem if I've done X, Y, and Z? You can look towards the Kupa Shel Shrotzim, which is on the king. That if you see that David HaMelech, even the Melech HaMashiach, has a lineage which has all these, you know, things going on that we would never hope for, you know, personally, with this poor background, he was able to reach such spiritual heights that can serve as a model for all of Klal Yisrael to be inspired as well. So far, we have three approaches to answer the basic question. And the basic question was, why was it necessary that David and the Melech HaMashiach need to come from what seemed to be, you know, a quote-unquote tainted lineage with these seemingly scandalous stories? And then we had it with other salvations as well, with Yael, Yehudis, and Esther. So the three basic approaches were either that at the time of salvation, Hashem wants to distract the Satan from being able to point Hashem towards acting with the Midos HaDin, and therefore he kind of enshrouds it in things that the Satan perceives as being Tameh. We had that to show that Hashem's glory can come from anywhere and everywhere, because Hashem's Kiddush, Hashem's holiness fills the entire world. And also to humble the leader in terms of remembering where he came from, and at the same time to inspire others. Now, some of these work for beyond David HaMelech. The certainly the one of the shochad for the satan works when it comes to all these yeshuas. It works for the story of Yael, and it works for any time that Hashem is bringing a yeshua. He wants it to be enshrouded. So even if you have the Esther, which had nothing to do with the house of David HaMelech specifically, the fact that yeshua had to come still with her giving herself up to this Achashverosh, to this king. Also, is a yeshua which comes with this distraction there, and also coming from such roots. In terms of the humbling, maybe that reason applies specifically to David HaMelech. I wanted to maybe just add one approach. I didn't see this anywhere, but one other idea that I was thinking. I don't think it has to be mutually exclusive, but maybe another aspect, which I think answers all the questions, not just in terms of the Melech HaMashiach, but all of these salvations. What message is Hashem trying to teach us? I thought maybe that the message is one of what being a leader in Klal Yisrael is all about. That a leader of Klal Yisrael, or leaders in general, are sometimes faced with very difficult decisions. And these are decisions that affect the future of Klal Yisrael. What's going to happen for generations to come? And true leadership requires being able to balance a fine line of halacha with a very careful analysis of the situation in terms of realizing, well, what needs to be done right now. So much so that it may even jeopardize the leader, him or herself, physically or even spiritually. But that's the challenge that the leader of Klal Yisrael faces. So when you have somebody, you have an Esther, or you have Rus, or you have Tamar, what were they willing to do? They were all willing to sacrifice everything that they had. They had no idea what was going to happen. Tamar didn't know what was going to happen, and she did. She was about to be burned at the stake with Yehuda. Wouldn't have said anything. She was willing to die because she realized, okay, my role is, however exactly she knew it, through Nevuah or whatever it was, she knew that I needed to be the one to give birth to the future of the Malchus based of it, and I'm willing to sacrifice my own life, and I was willing to sacrifice spiritually also by standing out there on the crossroads. But that's the sacrifice that I needed to make for Klal Yisrael, even if I had to give up something myself. And the same thing with Rus. Again, it seems to me from the reading of the story that Rus was fully prepared for anything that Boaz did to her that night. It ended up working out. And what happens if Boaz would have turned around and shot her with a gun? With a knife. Whatever it was. But in the middle of the night, this woman's lying in by his feet. He doesn't know she doesn't know how he's going to react. Or maybe, he won't survive this test and she'll end up spiritually giving herself up that night to him. Okay, in that case, everything worked out, but what was she willing to do? And she left her family, and she left so much, but that's the leadership of Klal Yisrael. And Esther also. Esther gave up everything. She gave up her husband, she gave up her life, she lived in the king, she lived in the palace, she gave herself up everything. So that's what she realized. Again, Mordechai, with his insight of Nevuah, realized that's what it means to be. And even the daughters of Lot, it seems to be on the surface that they acted l'shem shamayim. They really thought there was no other man alive in the world. They thought the entire world had been destroyed. And they said, we feel this responsibility in order to make sure that the humanity isn't demolished. We have the opportunity to make sure that more children are born, and we're going to take that role. And I think the idea is that sometimes it's very easy to make the cut and dry and the obvious decisions, but it's the more difficult ones when someone else is going to have to play them out and have to act, that's very difficult. And it's easy to make decisions for somebody else and say, okay, you know, you should do that, you should do this. But when the decisions are you giving up something yourself and you realizing that, okay, I might have to sacrifice myself physically or spiritually for the benefit of Klal Yisrael, that's really a measure of true leadership. And perhaps that's another aspect which I think can work together with any of the other answers which Hashem is revealing. That when it comes to the Melech HaMashiach, when it comes to all the salvation of Klal Yisrael, where it required true leadership to show its face, it was done in such a way that the leaders would have to make these tough decisions and were faced with them and would have to teach that all of Klal Yisrael for the future, that, okay, you can't decide on your own you know, to do certain things, you need guidance, you need, whether it's nevuah, whether you need to consult with somebody, whether you're on the level yourself, to do things that are questionable halakhically. Again, we're not allowed to violate what the Torah says, but again, maybe to push the brinks and sacrificing for the future of Klal Yisrael. What the Gemara talks about maybe a little bit with Yah, we had the idea of Avera Lishma, that sometimes an Avera can actually be more for the sake of heaven than a mitzvah is. But again, it's a calculation that requires a much broader knowledge and insight, but it's one that Hashem shows us is part of the characteristics of the leadership of Klal Yisrael. So maybe those ideas together will hope, I think, bring together a lot of the stories that we've discussed over the course of the year in terms of things that we looked at, because they do seem problematic on the surface, and we tried to understand that each story, I think you can understand in a vacuum. We also, we hadn't even mentioned, you have Abraham with Sarah being taken, and you have Avimelech. There's so many stories, and all of these things, if we understand that these were difficult decisions that were made, and sometimes it was Hashem enshrouding them to distract the Satan, or for any other reasons that we gave, then hopefully that gives a little bit of a broader approach and understanding to these stories, and Be'ezras Hashem, we'll continue learning other things in the future.
Okay.